Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do polling organizations assess trends in public opinion, and how do elected leaders use those opinions to craft campaign strategy and public policy? Mark Kennedy served in the U.S. House of Representatives from 2001 until 2007, following a career in business, and now is professor of political management and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. He's in town to moderate a panel discussion this evening on public opinion and White House decision-making. The event is sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Mark, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Generally speaking, what do the most respected political polling organizations have in common?
Well, they are seeking for an accurate view of what the voter thinks, and not just from the broad perspective, but from micro perspectives of key audiences that they need to convince.
Very often polling organizations tend to be associated with one party or the other. Theoretically, should they achieve the same results if they're doing their polling right?
They should, and you can adjust the poll as to how you ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to influence public opinion by putting out a poll that says what you want it to say, that's often done. But if you're trying to advise a president, which is the focus of our event tonight, because our Society of Presidential Pollsters is only those pollsters that have advised the president in the White House, that president needs an accurate read, and good pollsters would come up with the same accurate read.
And, of course, sometimes a president will see a poll and still have to act in a way that doesn't necessarily reflect what the majority of Americans want to see.
Absolutely. One of the things we'll be talking about is that presidential leadership dilemma. Sometimes what's good for the country, good for the world, isn't necessarily good for your base in the upcoming election. So how do you address that? We'll go through a number of examples, whether it be LBJ deciding to take up Kennedy's charge of having civil rights reform, which clearly hurt the party in the South. You look at more recent things as to what's been done with Bush leading immigration or Clinton pushing for welfare reform and NAFTA, both cases where the president has done something that's unpopular with their base, but they need to know who's that's popular with, who's it's not, how can they sell it, what messaging points will work.
Do presidents also use polling to craft language, or is that something that happens at other levels of the
No, it absolutely is used to craft language, because how do you position something is vital in terms of whether people are responding favorably or not to that. You know, a lot of times when you're having a debate also, the real outcome is who controls the question. You know, is the issue of climate, change, is that a question of are we going to stop the beaches from rising in Florida, or do you want to kill the economy? Those are the battles of the question, and whoever wins the battle of the question wins the outcome. And so understanding what question you want to have in people's minds when they're addressing that issue is vitally important, and polls can tell you which question is more likely to have you be the victor in the outcome.
And it raises the really interesting question of whether a president or any elected leader should seek to simply reflect what people want or to influence what people want.
That is the ongoing dilemma, because clearly in a democracy, there is an expectation to be responsive to the will of the people. But also, clearly, the people aren't always right. Example would be Churchill, who for a decade was trying to convince the British electorate that Germany was a rising threat. At that time, 90% of the British people supported disarmament. And because 90% of the people were wrong and the politicians generally followed them, millions more people died than needed to die. So there is times when public opinion, either through an exhaustion of dealing with a certain topic or preset prejudices they have, doesn't always come up with the right view. So there are times when a real leader has to step forward and try to convince the people otherwise. And again, polling can help them do that and help them figure out what messaging points will change the debate.
Give us your assessment on how well or poorly the media tend to cover poll results and how accurately they tend to cover poll results.
Well, they don't necessarily do that good of a job, because as I mentioned, it's easy to change one or two words and have the outcome be radically different.
Mm-hmm.
And the sampling is also an easy thing to look at to say this poll is or is not accurate. And a lot of times media outlets don't want to necessarily have a steady state, things always be the same. They want it to bounce back and forth, you know.
Makes a better headline, right?
They're ahead, they're behind, big change on this. And that can easily be accomplished by just a small twisting of the dial in how you're sampling, how you're expecting a voter outcome to be, whether they're actually going to vote or not. Those adjustments can make different outcomes. So too often, for better or for worse, media is tempted to do what makes a good headline and sells more papers or gets more people to listen, as opposed to keeping an intense focus on, is this an accurate result?
And, of course, polls can be wrong. There's the famous Dewey beats Truman story where people, the polls after the election seemed to indicate one result, and, in fact, the result was quite different.
One of the more difficult aspects of getting an accurate poll these days is that the days of catching somebody at home on their landline are over.
Mm-hmm.
And increasingly, particularly amongst the young, they're only relying on a cell phone. And our attention span is shrinking. So the ability to get an accurate poll by doing all the test questions is harder. And then you put on top of that, you really don't know who is going to be the ultimate voter because turnout models have changed. With big data being able to target specific groups that you can get an exaggerated turnout from, understanding and reflecting how good your opponent's going to be at turning out versus how good you are affects the accuracy of the polls. So technology changes are making it increasingly difficult to have a predictive, accurate poll.
How do you account for people who, for whatever reason, simply don't want to participate? They might be likely voters. They might be strongly opinionated. They might know what they want, but they just don't want to answer any questions.
It's difficult, but again, if you have a pattern of engaging those that do want to engage and you can predict the pattern of voting for those that don't want to engage, you can come up with an outcome. But those are the things that make polling accurately more difficult. And so we're pleased tonight to have Mark Penn, who was the pollster for President Clinton and for Hillary Clinton, and also Jan van Leeuwen, who was the pollster for President Bush, as well as was one of the pollsters in the Romney campaign. So we have professionals on both sides that have wrestled with these issues for decades in multiple campaigns, both in a corporate and a presidential setting, have advised presidents in the White House, and we're very much looking forward to the insights that they will be able to share in tonight's panel.
What are your insights with regard to, I mean, clearly there is a science behind polling. There are statistical ways to do things properly, and there's methodology that continues to evolve. On the other hand, there's an art to crafting questions that not evoke specific responses necessarily, but evoke accurate responses and really reflect what people are thinking.
It's a learned skill, and you, in many ways, learn from mistakes, and you learn from having a broad perspective. And that's where the pollster is one of the most valued members of any campaign team and one of the first you pick. So, and there's a number of different audiences that you are polling for. In one case, you're polling for your client, in this case, the president. But in the other case, you have to convince a certain number of members in the legislature to support their agenda. So how does this sell in Peoria? Or how does it sell in Dallas are things that you need to be aware of. So it's not just the broad, but the micro from a district perspective, but also from a segment. How will this sell to a certain voter segment? And how do you position it to a voter segment? And how does that positioning with this voter segment impact whether or not a different voter segment will respond well to that or not? So it takes a very broad view that can go both deep as well as broad and address multiple audiences.
I recognize that different presidents do things different ways, but how often typically would a poll be brought to the president for consideration?
Well, if you look at Mark Penn, he sat down weekly with President Clinton. We're pleased that at the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University that Mark has contributed his notes from those meetings to our school. They're held, not able to be released for a while for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. But ultimately That's a weekly conversation. And Mark would tell you that he viewed himself as sort of the voice of the voter. There's sort of multiple other voices out there, different constituencies that have their representation within the White House and decision-making process. But that's a weekly process, and each week you'd look at things and talk about what do I need to know for the next week and keep your eye out during the week. What's changed? What's happening? How do we adjust?
How important is it for any leader to fully understand the position of the opposition, not simply for strategic purposes, but also to really sort of bring that into consideration when making decisions?
It is absolutely vitally important, because if you look at our electoral framework here in America, how do you get something done? You can either agitate or you can get to action. To get to action, you need to get 60 votes in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And that typically requires getting a slice of the other side. As I say, I happen to be Republican, but our school is full spectrum, addressing those from all political persuasions. But we Republicans haven't had 60 votes in the Senate for 90 years. So I don't want to wait 90 years to get action. I need to get a slice of the other side. You can't get to the other side unless you can understand what motivates them and figure out how you can appeal to those motivations and attract them in a way that doesn't turn off your own base.
Does polling ever change presidents' minds? Does it cause them to sort of back off things they wanted to do?
Well, it I'm sure influences their decisions. On the one hand, you know, the Bush administration has, and those within it would say that their view of polling is it doesn't change their minds as to what to do. It helps us understand how to communicate that. Hmm. Others would say that you're clearly going to have to have that as an input in a democratic process, and it's a key variable. Whether it changes your mind, whether it's the ultimate decision maker, I don't know. It depends on the issue. But I think it would be wise for any person that's in a political office to understand how this is being perceived and how they are best able to communicate the outcome that they are seeking to achieve.
How much does polling, Mark, affect the way that campaign platforms are built? And do you have to be careful about sort of building a campaign that is somehow less than the sum of its parts because it comes only from poll results?
You do. I mean, it begins with any person running for office's own convictions. Mm-hmm. And what I say, having had the opportunity to run four campaigns, is that polling never told me how I was going to think about an issue, but it told me which of the issues I'm going to talk about with a particular audience. If we disagree on a particular topic, but I know we agree on another topic, I'll talk to you about the topic we can agree on and be prepared to respond to the one we disagree on. But a campaign, to be successful, has to connect with a certain number of segments to get it to 50% plus one. And so it needs to know of the things that it in its heart it agrees with, it is most profitably can talk about with which audiences to get them to support them in the end. So I've never perceived in my own mind that it changes my views, but it certainly can target which issues I talk about in which manner with which segments.
We're speaking this hour with Mark Kennedy. He is director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University and a former U.S. congressman from Minnesota. He'll be moderating the public opinion and White House decision-making panel discussion this evening at 6:30 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel. The event is sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join us and ask a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former U.S. Congressman Mark Kennedy from Minnesota. He's currently director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and he's in town to moderate a panel discussion, for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. It's about public opinion and White House decision-making. It happens tonight at 6:30. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Can you talk, Mark, about the relationship between the skills required to be a good political pollster as compared with somebody who specializes in, say, campaign fundraising or strategy or communications? They're related, right, but not the same.
Well, in each case, you need to know your audience and how you convince your audience of what needs to be done. Clearly, from a fundraiser, as I say, when you're raising money for a political end, you need to be able to convince people of they want you to win and that you will win.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting those messaging points down, you know, there's a degree of polling in that, public opinion. Is this message, I always say to every candidate, you need three reasons why they want you to win, three reasons why you will win, and the three reasons why they want you to win might vary by the audience. So you have to have sort of that inherent idea of a pollster in your mind as a fundraiser. Similarly, as a field operations, how do I get people to show up for parades? How do I have people holding signs around me at a rally? You need to know for the targeted people you're trying to turn out what's going to motivate them. So there needs to be a degree of a pollster's insights in that field operation as well. So I think all of them have the similar aspects of polling, understanding people's points of view, understanding what motivates them, understanding what messagings best resonate with them, and that, again, why a pollster is such a vital component to any campaign.
So you teach a class at George Washington in principled political leadership. There is so much cynicism these days about the ethical standards and morality of professional politicians. Is that an unfair characterization?
I think for the most part it is, but we're looking to go beyond that. You know, the interesting thing is, having gone to Congress, you're surprised that 90% of the people are normal people. But there's the 5% fringes on either side that are, you know, looking for hysteria, looking for shooting arrows at the other side, looking for kicking up a storm. And those are the most attractive to the media.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those voices that get the most play. And those voices that are the ones that people think are the real persona of Congress. The other challenge you have, though, is that Houston is different than Boston. And everybody in Houston walks around thinking everybody, you know, we all agree, why can't we get something done? But they've never been in Boston, where everybody else all agrees for the most part, but they completely disagree with Houston. And Congress is a reflection of the people. And the people are wildly different in terms of their views and nearly equally divided on just about everything. So getting that done is hard. There's also is many ethical dilemmas that you face in Congress of tugs and pulls, and they're not easy, whether it be campaigning or legislating, that we address with. But that ultimately begins with having a good understanding of yourself and a good understanding of how do I communicate not just with my side but the other side?
Talk a little bit about communicating across the aisle, because I think the assumption is based on what people see, the little glimpses that we get of what's going on, that it's impossible to have a decent conversation and that there is no agreement except perhaps behind sort of closed, locked doors.
And it's gotten more difficult because one of the things I was going to do, for example, was do a survey of the media. How do they portray the person that stands your grounds, won't budge for an inch for anything, versus the person that figures out a way to accommodate the other side, reach an agreement, get a little win-win, adjust here, bend there, to get it done? And usually that second is viewed as the demon and the other is viewed as the hero.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to get past the Houston versus Boston and get a resolution, you need people in the middle that are figuring out a way to find a path where each side is bending a little, but we're moving forward in a way that's better for the country. And so you're up against stereotypes that make it very hard to actually move beyond agitation to action, because although people want action, they want their action, not other people's action, and the difficulty of reconciling one person's perfect solution with another's perfect solution requires compromise, which has been demonized, requires trying to find priority balances where you can take, okay, you're not going to get your second priority, but you're going to get your first priority, and so am I, but I'm going to have to give up this other segment. So it's really difficult expectations that the people have put on politicians, and helping our leaders figure out a way to navigate through that is a difficult challenge that we're having to rise to.
There's also the issue of how congressional districts are drawn to favor one party or the other, and the reality in recent years that we've heard that the demographics of the country are changing, such that people of like political mind are sort of moving to the same areas when they can. How does that affect the ability to really represent a broad cross-section of people as opposed to the obligation of any elected leader to really, really only serve the base of his or her party?
It makes it very, very difficult. You know, we've gone from the day when out of the 435 members of Congress that, you know, 120 of them were swing districts, where you're worried more about the general election than the primary election. And now we're down to really having less than 40. So 90% of the members of Congress are more worried about a primary as opposed to a general election. So therefore, you not only have the fact that Houston is different than Boston, but they're just worried about the Republicans in Houston and the Democrats only worried about the Democrats in Boston, which are the left of the left or the right of the right, and have real no motivation nor interest nor reward for figuring out how to come to the middle. And this has made things extremely difficult. At the same time, when I grew up, we really only had one TV channel that was available, Northern Minnesota, NBC. And when I got to college and heard about things like Leave It to Beaver, I had no idea what people were talking about because I hadn't even heard the other channels. But then you basically had homogenous ABC, NBC, CBS that everybody got their news from. Mm-hmm. So they all had the same source. Now there are thousands, if not billions, of choices. And when I asked students at the beginning of class, if you hear a news, breaking news, where do you turn to? You have 40 students, you probably have 25 answers. And if you like vanilla, you don't choose chocolate. So people are getting self-reinforcing news, which makes the electorate more divided, which makes it harder for politicians to work. So it's in this environment that we have to address how can we move beyond agitation to action? And it's gotten more difficult than it has been any time before.
Can you talk a little bit about when you arrive? I know that there is an orientation for freshman congressional representatives. Can you talk about that orientation and then how that is supplemented by the members of your party sort of taking you under their wing and saying, this is how we do things on this side of the aisle?
Well, when you do an orientation, and I had an interesting orientation since I won in 155 votes out of 290,000 cast, so I was never sure whether...
Kind of a nail-biter.
I was never sure whether this was, you know, an orientation to, you know, that would last 2 weeks and you'd be out in a recount. But each side has their own orientations. So you might do the party's orientation and you might do Heritage, you know, on one side, and the Democrats have a similar one. Being a Kennedy, I did accept the invitation to go to the Kennedy School's orientation at Harvard. And I found that helpful. But they are telling you again, you know, here's our messaging points in many ways, or in the case of Kennedy, a more generalist, broad backgrounds on the issues. But I think the real challenge is that, again, you're not going to get to the outcome you need unless you can understand the motivations of mm-hmm. the other side as well. And that's something that we're very focused on trying to deliver in the principal political leadership class that we have at the Graduate School of Political Management.
Tell us about the students that you have in that class and what their aspirations are and how that affects the kinds of things that are taught in the class.
Well, an example of this would be we just recently had our gave away some Alumni Achievement Awards. We always give a red-blue. The red was Matt Rhodes, Romney's campaign manager, a graduate of our school, as well as Ann Caprera, the political director for the Democratic Senatorial Committee, also a graduate of our program. And when they gave the sort of acceptance speeches, they both mentioned the fact that during their time at GSPM, they met friends from the other side that they've kept close to. It's policy difference that creates conflicts. There are 285 policy schools creating ever more perfect solutions. we are the one school of politics. So we don't get into policy. We don't get in those conflicts. It's how do you advance whatever it is you're trying to advance. And so one of the big things about that is that they actually do meet people from the other side and get to know them. And having that broader view and having a network of people on both sides of the aisle is one thing that we're looking for. But it's those types of people that are leading campaigns that are also legislative leaders. Both the Senator Gillibrands and Coons chief of staff are our graduates, as are Culbertson's and Latta's chief of staff graduates of our program. But they're heading public affairs firms. They're heading vice presidents of government affairs for corporations. And they're communication directors for the House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Teamsters, Hilton Worldwide, and Bono's One campaign.
Is it your hope that your students will hang on to that cooperative spirit? Because it seems that many people have very idealistic goals when they enter politics, and then they actually get a job in politics and realize that a lot of what they hoped to do becomes impossible because of the realities of running a campaign when you have strong opposition.
You do have strong opposition, and you can get delusion. But one of the things I try to convince them of is that if you're able to sell to the other side, you're more likely to get your views advanced. When I first started talking about it in class, a lot of the students were a little leery that this was a conservative Republican trying to convince me that I need to change my views.
Like they were afraid you were going to brainwash them somehow?
Somehow. I don't know how. We are the school of, by, and for political partisans, so we're not trying to change your partisan view, whatever it is. But what we're trying to convince you of is the best politicians are able to speak, see both sides, and speak to both sides. And one of the things I do is I go through some speeches of Obama and President Bush and Kennedy and others. And we go through the big divisions, a Hayek or market-oriented economics versus Keynes, government-driven or economics, and Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt on foreign policy of America Leads, and Woodrow Wilson, you know, that deferred to the UN. And we go through their speeches and show that in the times when they were speaking to both sides and everybody in the audience felt spoke to, those speeches were effective. But that when they were only speaking to one side, it just created friction and not action. But showing that, Paul, you can show examples of both President Obama and President Bush speaking to both sides of saying, you know, you may not think they're the best politicians, but they won two national campaigns. They're doing it. If you want to be an effective politician, even better than them, you need to do it and do it better.
Have we lost respect in this country for even the offices that our elected leaders hold? It does seem that there are Democrats who see a Republican on TV and instantly sort of get their hackles up. There are Republicans who see a Democrat on TV and do the same thing, to the point that we have so much skepticism in the sort of population that votes that very many people aren't even willing to listen to an argument that is being made to appeal to a broader audience.
I think that's very true if you just look at the approval rating of Congress. Actually, a part of my time in Congress was 50%. Now it's down to 15% perhaps at best. And that's not good for the country. Now, part of that is the process itself. You know, part of it's unrealistic expectations on the part of the voters that think everybody in the country thinks just like them. But part of it is that there hasn't been enough of that rising above what's right for my specific district or my party to what's best for the country. Mm-hmm. And I think more of that leadership would help. Two examples would be the debt. There's no doubt that we need to address the debt. One side thinks it all can be done by cutting spending. The other thinks it can all be done by cutting taxes. Neither side is willing to budge. This might be a situation where Theodore Roosevelt said in a moment of decision, the best thing to do is the right thing. The next best thing to do is the wrong thing. The worst thing to do is nothing. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that doing nothing on the debt, everybody understands, is the worst thing, and we continue to do it. And no leader really has grappled with coming up with something that we can actually put into action. Similarly, immigration. Immigration is another one of those things. Whatever your motivation is on either side, the current state of affairs does not adequately address what you're trying to achieve in immigration. And so doing something needs to be done. So I think the unwillingness for a leader to step forward and address at least those two big issues and a few others has increased the disillusion. And I think that there is more support out there with the people, and they would be more understanding to bold decisions if the leaders step forward to take them.
On these issues where there is at least broad agreement that we need to take some kind of action, is how much of the backdoor politicking has to do with face-saving measures for one side or the other to make something palatable that ostensibly doesn't seem to reflect what voters wanted?
It's huge. I mean, part of the problem that the Republicans have with the current president is that whenever they sort of make sort of a compromise agreement with him, he's always, you know, dancing on, you know, that he's won and that he's somehow beat the Republicans. And if you do that, it's going to be harder to bring him to the table again. You could say the reverse for a party. I'm not trying to be partisan in this case. But that's one of the interesting things we do in our class is we take the biggest issue facing us. Last semester, it was the government shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Solve us something for that. This semester, it was immigration. And I tell them that they have to pick a member of Congress that they're representing. We break into groups of five, and they have to come up with a solution that is plausible getting through both the Senate, House, and the presidency, is budget neutral. One of them does a floor speech for that member. One of them does the whip count of who are the key votes going to be for you to get that passed. One of them does the which outside organizations are you going to get rallying on your side. One does the how will it affect your campaign back home. One does the how does it appeal to the different styles of Congress, whether party leaders or committee leaders or just bringing back bacon back home folks. And in that, when they do the speeches, I'm oftentimes having to identify the what I call the nails on the blackboard phrases.
Things that will make some people crazy just to hear them.
Yes. And if you ought to know that you're using words that are nailed on the blackboard to the other side,
mm-hmm.
and only use them when you want to be using them. But if you're truly trying to get a slice of the other side to agree with you, if you use those, they're less likely to come to your side.
We're speaking this hour with former U.S. Congressman Mark Kennedy. He's currently director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and he's in town to moderate a panel discussion this evening on public opinion and White House decision-making. It starts at 6:30 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel, and it's sponsored by the World Affairs Council. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former Minnesota Congressman Mark Kennedy, currently director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and in town to moderate a panel discussion on public opinion and White House decision-making. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Demir, who says, I have a question from Istanbul, Turkey. If media shapes public opinion, how can we shape media opinion?
Well, it's very difficult, and obviously a lot of activist groups try to do just that. But a big part of it is how free is the press? And that's not always the case. Clearly in Istanbul and our school at the Graduate School of Political Management teaches a new master's called Advocacy in the Global Environment. How do you advocate around the world, not just Washington or Austin, but Beijing, Brussels, Brasilia, monarchs in the Middle East, and Istanbul. And we were in Istanbul last August. We'll be there again this August. They're right after the Gezi Park protest. And a big problem they had was that the local CNN affiliate, well, people were out in the streets protesting a huge transformative protest that ultimately resulted in millions of people coming out. They were running a show on penguins and not even covering it.
So the rest of the world got coverage and Turkey itself didn't get that coverage.
Yes. And as you may have heard, they banned Twitter right before the election. It got opened up afterwards because if you can't get your own media to pay attention, social media has been an outlet, and the government's trying to crack down on that as well. In the case of Turkey, too many of the media outlets are controlled by conglomerates that have heavy business operations with the government, so it's not in their economic interest to do that. But we've seen similar things in Brazil, where the government is a much higher piece of the overall economy, and the current government is directing ad buys by government and government-owned companies towards those media outlets that are friendly to them, putting intense pressure on media outlets to not be critical of the government. So I can just not stress enough how fragile and how important freedom of the press is. It's something that we, of course, here in America are committed to in our First Amendment, but that's not something that in my mind gets enough attention. But it's being both having activist groups that can get a message out and get that channeled. It's looking for multiple channels, but it's ultimately seeking outside help from other countries to put pressure on you need to have freedom of press in your own country if we're really going to view you as a legitimate democracy.
What about coverage in this country where the government doesn't step in to limit the content? However, corporations need to make money, and very often the political coverage that makes the most money is very, very partisan on one side or the other, and not necessarily the coverage that is inclined to try to take things down the middle as much as it's possible.
Well, that is very true. I mean, I would just direct you to the New York Times bestseller list. That at any given point in time, out of the top 10 bestsellers, we'll probably have one best-selling book that's the left of the left and one best-selling book that's the right of the right. And that reason sort of balanced, here's both sides of the issues, and if we really are going to get beyond just fighting about this to actually doing something about it, here's a path that we can get to the middle. That just doesn't sell. And so for better or worse, media is a business. And media will be responsive to what the people want. And so, again, the average citizen cannot put all the blame outside. The average citizen has to look in their own heart and understand, are they really devoted to finding both sides of the issue and finding a path towards a solution?
Did it come as a relief for you to move into your current job after 6 years in the House, where your colleagues are, in fact, people who have a broad range of political ideologies, and you're not only expected to get along with them, but you're sort of welcome to get along with them?
I wasn't as much of a foreigner in terms of transitioning from the Congress to academia as some, because I came from one of those districts that at the time was one of those 40 districts that was a swing district. 2 decades in a row, the Republicans and Democrats couldn't agree in Minnesota, so the courts decided it. And I had a very balanced district that was entirely focused from the beginning on the middle 20%. I knew I had to do X to make sure that I had my 40% with me, but my whole focus was that middle 20%. And so for me, it was a bit of less of a transition.
Is there, and forgive me because I don't mean this to sound as flip as it does, is there a sort of a pro-wrestling aspect to electoral politics in some ways? Did you have colleagues who were sort of required by the political opinions within their districts to proclaim very extreme views on one side or the other, who would say to you, Mark, if I could, I would do this, but it's just not possible, so I can't absolutely sort of speak my own mind?
Well, the best case of that is Barney Frank, because Barney Frank maintains a public persona of being, you know, crazy and radical and going off in a tantrum on certain issues. But face-to-face, he is easy to work with and very constructive in terms of his approach. And so, frankly, by maintaining a persona on the outside, keeps his base with him, but that gives him the ability then to work with the other side and actually work on constructive solutions. So I think that Barney Frank is perhaps the best example of, yes, I need to maintain the energy of my base, but I'm doing that in many ways to allow myself the freedom of being a very effective legislator. And during my time serving with him on the Financial Services Committee, I found him to be one of the people on the other side that I could work with.
How are you preparing students to endure being in the hot seat in terms of having to answer tough questions and face constituents who might not be happy with their decisions?
Well, it is a challenge. You first of all need to work on the communication techniques. You have to understand conflict resolution techniques. You have to understand the art of persuasion. But you ultimately need to have a degree of internal fortitude and understand that as a professional that you can't let the emotions of the moment capture your mind, and that you need to stick with, what are the values you're standing for, what are the facts that you're basing your decisions on, and what actions you're trying to achieve.
How did you find the work of being a congressman matched up with the expectations you had before you had the job?
I always tell folks it's more fun and more work than you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I tried not to get picked up before 6:30 in the morning, and I tried to get home by 10 o'clock when I was home in Minnesota so I could have a glass of wine with my wife. And I ended up working about 6 2/3 days a week for the time I was in Congress. So you work very hard. You also find one of the more challenging things is there are some things you don't care about, mm-hmm. but you have to have a point of view on
right.
it. And then when somebody from the other side comes up and challenges you on something you really don't care about, you have to be able to defend a point of view. There's challenges to being in Congress. On the flip side, there's rewards. My son, who is now a U.S. Navy pilot, had an opportunity to fly out aboard the USS John F. Kennedy with me at sea when he was 17. My daughter was able to go to Reagan's funeral with me and meet every president, vice president, and first lady since she was born. I stood a little closer to her when I introduced her to Clinton than when I introduced her to Carter. after I lost, I got two Democrats to sign up for the White House Christmas party that they weren't planning on going to, but list my two younger children as their guests so that their name would be on the list when we got there.
Hmm.
And a daughter got to play the piano and get new hair and shoes for the party. And my son, when he was walking up to visit the lineup for the pitcher, he was the first one in the row of our family. And when President Bush saw him, he looked up at him since he looks just like me and said, "Kennedy." So to be recognized by the leader of the free world because your dad, you look just like your dad, is a big thrill. So there are thrills to it, but it is a lot of work. It's a noble profession, even if not necessarily admired as much by the public. And I would encourage those that have that urge to do so, but to do so for the right reason, to serve, to advance things that they feel would make the world better.
Would it make lawmakers better at their jobs, in the House in particular, if they were not running every 2 years, which essentially means you're running all the time, raising money all the time, and also trying to do the work of being a congressional representative?
First of all, I don't spend time speculating on that as much because the senators would never allow it, because they don't want to have more competition running for Senate. And House members that run for Senate, as I did, have to give up their House seats mm-hmm. in order to run. And so that'll never happen. But I feel that as the people's House, that has to be truly responsive to the people. It wasn't that big of a burden for me because it keeps you close and connected to the people. Raising money is a challenge, but in many ways, we could have another hour segment on how a lot of the campaign reforms have really made it more difficult because it's pushed money further and further away from the candidate and more and more irresponsible and further away from the candidate half the saying, "I'm Mark Kennedy and I approve of this message." I actually enjoyed campaigning. I might be one of those crazy people. Perhaps that's why I lead a school that, amongst other things, teaches campaigning.
We have an email here from Larry who wants to know, how did Nate Silver rise so far above the crowd in his perfect prediction in 2012?
Part of it's luck. Part of it's not allowing yourself to be distracted by, partisan assumptions, but he put a lot of technology into it as well. That's why we've focused more on that technology. We got a grant to do from Mark Schenkman to do a research on applying big data for political success, and we've greatly expanded our focus into digital campaigning because a lot of folks say, this is a learn-on-the-job profession, mm-hmm. politics. And then the next thing they'll do is they'll complain about getting waxed in the last election because of big data. And I'll say, well, if you want to learn big data on the job, you'll lose your election. and the degree to which politics is becoming much more sophisticated, as Nate Silver has shown, has told you you need to pay a lot of attention not just to the what you learned on the job, but what is the science of applying technology on behalf of who to target, what messages to target with them, who to turn out, whether you're going to get them to turn out.
Do you think more sophisticated analysis of big data could eventually supplant the traditional poll as we've known it in our history?
It's certainly going to change it and make it more it makes it more robust. And I would suggest to you that one metric you could say is to who's won the presidential race, you know, from 2000 on has been which party's been ahead on technology. In 2004, Karl Rove was saying that one woman came up to him and said, you know, your mailing is wrong because you mailed me a letter about pro-life. And Carl asked her, are you pro-life? And she said, yes, but nobody on my block is. And Carl said, well, you're the only one then that got that mailing on your block. And that was new in 2004. And we were clearly ahead on the micro-targeting in 2004. But when you look at 2008, there's no doubt that President Obama's campaign was far ahead. And I'm not convinced yet that the Republicans have caught up as much with the Democrats in this regard. But again, our party, our school, is in full spectrum. We're embracing those of all parties, but very much focused on making sure that all of those have the latest training and techniques that they can have in terms of using the latest tools and techniques available to both understand who your voter is and how do you persuade him and how do you get him out to vote.
Compare for me your students and their temperaments, I guess they're millennials essentially, with their Gen X and baby boomer counterparts who are already working in politics.
Well,
How are they different?
We actually have a variety of them because we offer our programs political management, how to win a campaign and advocate, legislative affairs, how to be a Hill staffer, strategic public relations, both face-to-face, online, in English, and also in Spanish, since we have a very strong representation throughout Latin America. The online people are about 10, 15 years older than the face-to-face because they're set in their positions. They have a career. They can't really leave. We had the chief of staff for the leader of the Senate in New York as one of our graduates. And so and even face-to-face, there's a variety of them. And so they learn from each other because we teach at night or online. And so there is no doubt that the millennials are much more in tune to social media and technology than those that are more advanced, but they're all eager to learn. And I would say, although we have elected officials that come from our program, we have a member of the Japanese Diet, their House of Representatives, the Mexican Senate, the Slovakian Parliament, that a lot of ours want to be the person behind the scenes, want to be the staff person. And so they're coming at this as a profession that they care very much about, that it's not just something they talk about over a beer after work, but they want to make their work. And so I think that's what makes our students unique.
Mark Kennedy is professor of political management and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and he's a former U.S. congressman from Minnesota. Tonight, he will moderate a panel discussion on public opinion and White House decision-making, sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Mark, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.